We're here for Sports Lit 101. Every week, Bruce talks with us about wonderful new books. Often we talk with the authors. This time around, we're going to hear about a book called The Age of Ruth and Landis.
Yeah, this is another one of the just incredible slew of great books coming out of University of Nebraska Press. It's by David George Surdam and Michael Hopert. And I only bring that up because they're both economics professors, Surdam at Northern Iowa and Hopert at University of Wisconsin. And so this book is a look at the economics of baseball in the 1920s. That's the lens, but it covers the whole scope of baseball. And we got to remember that in 1920, it's only 2 years after the Black Sox scandal. It's only 7 years after the Federal League War. And we're talking about the aftermath of World War I, and they didn't know what was going to happen to baseball. Now, there were 37 minor leagues at the time. Mm-hmm. There were not that many there was the American League and the National League, and they were all basically this side of the Mississippi. Not exactly, but everything was pretty much this way. There were no teams in the South. There was nobody south of Washington, D.C. And it was a game in urban cities. For years, people could only speculate on what the real economic situation was. But fortunately, one team, the New York Yankees, kept all their financial records from the time they were the Highlanders until, and they are available in an archive, and these guys were able to examine them. So a lot of what we think we knew about player salaries and like, we probably didn't know. But what happens is, it's historically been that people would say baseball was saved by Babe Ruth and Kennesaw Mountain Landis. Maybe not the case. In fact, the case is that if Babe Ruth had played anywhere else in New York, he probably would have cost his team money because you needed to have a huge population when bleachered seats, which were what most seats were 50 cents apiece to pay a guy who was making what Ruth was making, especially on a team that had a lot of other people that it was paying well. And Kennesaw Mountain Landis is hardly the straight arrow, stern old judge that people have been led to believe. And what we find out in this book is that he was erratic as a federal judge. He was overruled all the time by the Supreme Court. He was a bombastic guy. And he would, find someone like $75 million, knowing full well that was never going to be the case. And he handled baseball somewhat the same way. There's pretty good evidence that Ty Cobb and Tris Speaker were betting on games, right? Not against them, betting on games that they wanted to win that for the teams they played for or managed at the time. And they were essentially banished from the American League by Landis and Van Johnson, but they were allowed to come back in the National League, whereas other innocent guys, and I think the case that Shoeless Joe Jackson was probably innocent of what he was charged with, he would just banish them for life and it worked. So Landis was very mercurial, and as a result of that, he was constantly at war with the American League, especially the American League owners, Comiskey and Frazee and Rupert and some of the others, because he wanted to run baseball by himself. He didn't want to pay attention to the council. He reminds me of someone else. We won't even go there. But one of the things I think that's really interesting is James Hart, who was a Chicago owner of the White Sox, of the Cubs, rather, before Wrigley. We are the only paradoxical business institution in the world. My good is your ill. Your good is my ill. We compete for players. We compete for points. We compete for games. And it is an antagonistic business from start to finish. If it was not, we would not be in business. And why is that possible? Because of the reserve clause.
Right.
And because at the time, players signed one-year contracts. So you could sign a contract for $5,000 and you could hit 337, and because you hit 345 the year before, they would say, "Well, you didn't do as well, so we're gonna cut your money." So it was at a time the players had no rights. I mean, they had nothing whatsoever. And as many people pointed out, including Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia of New York, it's the only business where by doing better and move, you cannot do better and then move.
Yeah, and when you mentioned that, and I'm looking at the standings for 1920. It's 16 teams, 8 in each league. 11 of those 16 teams were in just 5 cities. Boston, Philadelphia, St. Louis, Chicago all had 2 teams, and there were 3 in New York.
Yeah. And in Boston, both teams were really struggling. I mean, the Red Sox and the Braves were really struggling at that point in time, and yet they forged on with two teams, and they just kept getting lower and lower payrolls and lower attendance. And then the odd thing was when Connie Mack's Philadelphia Athletics were winning all the time, they plummeted.
Well, because he sold off most of his good players.
But even before that, it plummeted because they were winning all the time, and people thought, it's not all that interesting. But here's some interesting stuff I did find out. Of course, as many people know, Landis tried not to give up his job as a federal judge. And the other person being touted was former President Taft.
Hmm.
And Taft, even when he was on the Supreme Court later, people thought he might rather be commissioner of baseball because it paid better.
Wow.
Right? Which really I thought was amazing. One of the things that's interesting, too, is that, you know, now teams want to have the guy that won the MVP. They want to have the guy that won the Cy Young. Owners didn't want those because they said as soon as you start giving out awards, they're going to want to get paid.
Right.
And the collusion, the rampant, bald-faced collusion to drive down player salaries between some of the owners was amazing. And then you get the other owners like Rupert, who said, no, you know, if I need to spend money, I'll spend money. There were times when you could be the owner of the Yankees and own a piece of the Red Sox because you own part of Fenway Park, which Rupert
right,
did.
Right.
The way that businesses were entangled and the crookedness of some of it was astonishing. I also had no idea how deep the gambling problem was in baseball. I mean, you know, we think about the White Sox, the Black Sox scandal, but really that was just one. There were lots of other ones, guys throwing games. People grooving pitches because they knew that if a guy got one, because his bonus would go up if he got one more home run. Hey, we're out of it, babe. This one's coming in right at the waist. You know, it's interesting because what they did was they found all this out by following the money. They why did certain teams do better than others? Why did certain teams sign certain players? Why was it that a player might sign for someone for way less money and then suddenly seem to be doing much better? Oh, the car dealership? We forgot to mention that, right?
Yeah.
And so a lot of rules that were passed that we're familiar with now about conflicts of interest began in the 20s, and they really got sort of ironed out in the 30s. But it's a remarkable book because that's for me the most fascinating decade of the 20th century is the 20s. I mean, I think culturally, historically, I took a class in that in college in the 20s, which was a fabulous class. So much of what we're dealing with today, or so much of the way baseball is today, rather, I should say, all that began in the 20s, the fight for free agency, the fight for to unionize, to do all these things, began in the 20s, not as you would think later on.
Well, and the idea of one aspect of the game being able to make more money for clubs emerged when you came out of what was known as the dead ball era. Ruth hit, I think it was in 1919, he hit 29 home runs, which was a record at the time.
More than six other teams.
Yeah. And people said, wow, we got to get guys like that. Whatever they did to the ball to make it travel more efficiently, including replacing baseballs. Because prior to that point, as I recall, they'd use the same baseball for as long as they could
until Chapman dies when he gets hit in the head and they decide it was because he couldn't see the ball because
right.
it was so dirty. But here's the other interesting thing these guys did. They looked at the mechanics of Ruth's swing and decided he was the first guy to change the launch angle. That he consciously, unlike Hornsby and unlike Speaker and unlike Cobb and the guys that punched at the ball to get singles, that he not only dug in, but he swung with more of an uppercut than other players. And they talk about he had to be that much better because Gehrig tried it, other people tried it, and they could not match his home run potential. But yeah, once the ball started flying out of the park, everybody said, I got to get me one of those.
Mm.
And that became the big race. And the fact that you used to have to buy people from the minors, they weren't the kind of agreements they had. The shadiness of some of this was really astonishing.
Now, the economy by the mid-20s was really thriving.
Yep.
Part of what made it the roaring 20s were things going as well for the baseball owners?
Yeah, it was funny because baseball bounced back first after the war, it bounced back as one of the top recreational activities. But because then when things got even better, sports like golf and tennis picked up. Baseball is still miles ahead at the time of any other professional sport. I mean, the professional sports are just off the radar.
Right. I mean, there was a National Hockey League, but it was off the radar.
Way off the radar. And it was, only 4 to 6 teams, depending on what years. The other thing that's interesting is that it was because that was a time when there was a tremendous amount of immigration. Baseball became among white people to be a particularly interesting way of ethnicities getting together. And this you're going to love. The Sporting News, which was so right-wing, wrote, "No nation in the world has developed a national sport of such universal and gripping interest. Our so-called aliens, hyphenates, unnaturalized immigrants take to baseball before they take to their citizenship paper." Goes on and on and on and on and talks about all the ideal of racial assimilation, amiable mutuality. The note from the authors is, "The editor appeared to be a few ethnicities shy of a rainbow coalition in this encomium."
Wow.
But it was the game of immigrants. And when the you look at leagues like the Pacific Coast League, which were almost major leagues, you know, they gave us the DiMaggio's later and Billy Martin. I mean, a lot of people came out of that. Baseball was a game, was one of the places where people of different ethnicities, white people,
right,
got together and played. And then, of course, in the barnstorming and off seasons, it's where black and white people play together. And it's interesting how much they did not want the barnstormers to play, go to Cuba and play against teams, because if they lost to a black team, that was going to be really. Well, but the players loved it.
And their primary competition among sports fans was not other team sports. It was boxing and horse racing.
Boxing, horse racing, and college sports were well privileged over professional sports. In fact, it was in the 20s when baseball owners started signing collegiate players, which they liked to do because they liked to get them after a couple of years of college because they said they're smart, they haven't played too many games, they've played enough games. And they talk about people like Gehrig signed out of Columbia, guys who were signed out of Fordham and other schools in New York, and how it was 67% of the people who played ball were from cities of 75,000 or more.
Wow.
We think of it as, we think of the farm kid today but it was really an urban game because kids playing out in the country, you might not get enough kids. There might not be enough kids to have a team. There were no coaches. And today, there are two states that do not have high school baseball.
Hmm.
South Dakota and Wyoming do not have high school baseball. They only have American Legion and AAU.
Hmm.
And Little League. So this book is, I want our readers to know that there are times when the pages and pages and pages at the back of facts and figures and things that are added on at the end. The book looks a lot bigger than it is, but it's really incredibly well researched. And if you're a baseball nerd, you really want this book.
Well, you mentioned what an interesting decade it was. One of my favorite recent books, and it came out 4, maybe 5 years ago, Bill Bryson's One Summer, all about 1927. And everything, not simply Babe Ruth and baseball, but Lindbergh.
Amy Semple McPherson.
And some big crimes that took place at that time. And it's a great read.
Yeah, the book we had in college that covered that decade was called The Aspirin Age. And it was and I think the subtitle for 1927 was Take Two Aspirin. Yeah, that was an amazing year.
It is 4:47, Sports Lit 101, every Wednesday. Next week, Bruce, you'll be checking in from, where are you going to be?
Lawrence, Kansas.
Wow.
97 degrees projected every day and 70 for the low. So I'm going to be inside a lot, except that one day I'm going fishing. But, I'll be at the Sport Literature Association conference, and we'll be finding out a lot about books that'll be coming out soon and the like.
Excellent.
I'll call in from down that way.
We'll look forward to it.